I'd risk. But after the practically perfect short speech from the ex-first baseman, O'Toole had nothing to say. After all, how could he refuse to respond to such a plea? All the Courtney Bothwells on the entire planet were counting on him. After sleeping for 5 hours, O'Toole awakened at 3 o'clock. He was aware that the most important action of his life was facing him. It seemed to him that everything he had done, his career, his religious studies, even his family activities, had been preparing him for this moment. God had trusted him with a monumental decision. But what did God want him to do? His forehead broke out in a sweat as O'Toole knelt before the image of Jesus on the cross that was behind his desk. "Dear Lord," he said, clasping his hands earnestly, "my hour approaches, and I still do not see thy will clearly. It would be so easy for me just to follow my orders and do what everyone wants. Is that thy desire? How can I know for certain?" Michael O'Toole closed his eyes and prayed for guidance with a fervor surpassing any he had felt previously. As he prayed, he recalled another time, years before, when he had been a young pilot working as part of a temporary peacekeeping force in Guatemala. O'Toole and his men had awakened one morning to find their small airbase in the jungle completely surrounded by the right-wing terrorists that were trying to bring the fledgling democratic government to its knees. The subversives wanted the planes. In exchange, they would guarantee safe passage to O'Toole and his men. Major O'Toole had taken 15 minutes to deliberate and pray before deciding to fight it out. In the ensuing battle, the planes were destroyed and almost half his men were killed. But his symbolic stand against terrorism emboldened the young government and many others throughout Central America at a time when the poor countries were struggling desperately to overcome the ravages of 2 decades of depression. O'Toole had been awarded the Order of Merit, the highest COG military accolade, for his exploits in Guatemala. On board the Newton, years later, General O'Toole's decision process was much less straightforward. In Guatemala, the young major had not had any questions about the morality of his actions. His order to destroy Rama, however, was altogether different. In O'Toole's opinion, the alien ship had not taken any overtly bellicose actions. In addition, he knew that the order was based primarily on 2 factors. Fear of what Rama might do, and the uproar of xenophobic public opinion. Historically, both fear and public opinion were notoriously unconcerned about morality. If somehow he could learn what Rama's true purpose was, then he could. Below the painting of Jesus on the desk in his room was a small statue of a young man with curly hair and wide eyes. This figure of St. Michael of Siena had accompanied O'Toole on every journey he had made since his marriage to Kathleen. Seeing the statue gave him an idea. General O'Toole reached into one of the desk drawers and pulled out an electronic template. He switched on the power, checked the template menu, and accessed a concordance indexing the sermons of St. Michael. Under the word Rama, the general found a host of different references in the concordance. The one that he was looking for was the only one marked in a bold font. That specific reference was the saint's famous Rama sermon, delivered in camp to a group of 5,000 of Michael's neophytes 3 weeks before the Holocaust in Rome. O'Toole began to read. "As the topic for my talk to you today, I am going to address an issue raised by Sister Judy in our council. Namely, what is the basis for my statement that the extraterrestrial spacecraft called Rama might well have been the first announcement of the second coming of Christ? Understand that at this point I have had no clear revelation one way or the other. God has, however, suggested to me that the heralds of Christ's next coming will have to be extraordinary, or the people on earth will not notice. A simple angel or two blowing trumpets in the heavens won't suffice. The heralds must do things that are truly spectacular to engage attention. There is a precedent, established in the Old Testament prophecies foretelling the coming of Jesus, of prophetic announcements originating in the heavens. Elijah's chariot was the Rama of its time. It was, technologically speaking, as much beyond the understanding of its observers as Rama is today. In that sense, there is a certain comforting pattern, a symmetry that is not inconsistent with God's order. But what I think is most hopeful about the arrival of the first Rama spacecraft 8 years ago, and I say first because I am certain there will be others, is that it forces humanity to think of itself in an extraterrestrial perspective. Too often, we limit our concept of God and, by implication, our own spirituality. We belong to the universe. We are its children. It's just pure chance that our atoms have risen to consciousness here on this particular planet. Rama forces us to think of ourselves and God as beings of the universe. It is a tribute to his intelligence that he has sent such a herald at this moment. For, as I have told you many times, we are overdue for our final evolution, our recognition that the entire human race is but a single organism. The appearance of Rama is another signal that it is time for us to change our ways and begin that final evolution. General O'Toole put down the template and rubbed his eyes. He had read the sermon before, right before his meeting with the Pope in Rome, in fact, but somehow it had not seemed as significant then as it did now. So, which are you, Rama, he thought? A threat to Courtney Bothwell, or a herald of Christ's second coming? During the hour before breakfast, General O'Toole was still vacillating. He genuinely did not know what his decision would be. Weighing heavily upon him was the fact that he had been given an explicit order by his commanding officer. O'Toole was well aware that he had sworn, when he had received his commission, not only to follow orders, but also to protect the Courtney Bothwells of the planet. Did he have any evidence that this particular order was so immoral that he should abrogate his oath? As long as he thought of Rama as only a machine, it was not too difficult for General O'Toole to countenance its destruction. His action would not, after all, kill any Ramans. But what was it that Wakefield had said? That the Raman spaceship was probably more intelligent than any living creatures on Earth, including human beings. And shouldn't superior machine intelligence have a special place among God's creations, perhaps even above lower life forms? Eventually, General O'Toole succumbed to fatigue. He simply had no energy left to deal with the unending stream of questions without answers. He reluctantly decided to cease his internal debate and prepared to implement his orders. His first action was to re-memorize his RQ code, the specific string of 50 integers between 0 and 9 that was known only by him and the processors inside the nuclear weapons. O'Toole had personally entered his code and checked that it had been properly stored in each of the weapons before the Newton mission had been launched from Earth. The string of digits was long to minimize the probability of its being duplicated by a repetitive electronic search routine. Each of the Newton military officers had been counseled to derive a sequence that met two criteria. The code should be almost impossible to forget and should not be something straightforward, like all the phone numbers in the family that an outside party might figure out easily from the personnel files. For sentimental reasons, O'Toole had wanted 9 of the numbers in his code to be his birth date, 3/29/42, and the birth date of his wife, 2/7/46. He knew that any decryption specialist would immediately look for such obvious selections, so the general resolved to hide the birth dates in the 50 digits. But what about the other 41 digits? That particular number, 41, had intrigued O'Toole ever since a beer and pizza party during his sophomore year at MIT. One of his associates then, a brilliant young number theorist whose name he had long forgotten, had told O'Toole, in the middle of a drunken discussion, that 41 was a very special number, the initial integer in the longest continuous string of quadratic primes. O'Toole never fully comprehended what exactly was meant by the expression quadratic prime. However, he did understand, and was fascinated by, the fact that the string 41, 43, 47, 53, 61, 71, 83, and 97, where each successive number was computed by increasing the difference from the previous number by 2, resulted in exactly 40 consecutive prime numbers. The sequence of primes ended only when the 41st number in the string turned out to be a non-prime, namely 41 times 41 equals 1,681. This little-known piece of information O'Toole had shared only one time in his life, with his wife Kathleen on her 41st birthday, and he had received such a lackluster response that he had never told anybody about it again. But it was perfect for his secret code, particularly if he disguised it properly. To build his 50-digit number, General O'Toole first constructed a sequence of 41 digits, each coming from the sum of the first two digits in the corresponding term in the special quadratic prime sequence beginning with 41. Thus, 5 was the initial digit, representing 41, followed by 7 for 43, 1 for 47, 4 and 7 equal 11, and then truncate, 8 for 53, etc. O'Toole next scattered the numbers of the two birthdates using an inverse Fibonacci sequence, 34, 21, 13, 8, 5, 3, 2, 1, and 1, to define the locations of the new 9 integers in the original 41-digit string. It was not easy to commit the sequence to memory, but the general did not want to write it down and carry it with him to the activation process. If his code were written down, then anyone could use it, with or without his permission, and his option to change his mind again would be precluded. Once he had re-memorized the sequence, O'Toole destroyed all his computations and went to the dining room to have breakfast with the rest of the cosmonauts. Here's a copy of my code for you, Francesca, and one for you, Irina. And the final one goes to Hiro Yamanaka. Sorry, Janos, Admiral Heilmann said with a big smile, but I'm all out of bullets. Maybe General O'Toole will let you enter his code into one of the bombs. It's all right, Herr Admiral, Janos said wryly. Some privileges in life I can do without. Heilmann was making a big production out of activating the nuclear weapons. He had had his 50-digit number printed out multiple times, and had enjoyed explaining to the other cosmonauts how clever he had been in the conception of his code. Now, with uncharacteristic flair, he was allowing the rest of the crew to participate in the process. Francesca loved it. It was definitely good television. It occurred to O'Toole that Francesca had probably suggested such a staging to Heilmann, but the general didn't spend much time thinking about it. O'Toole was too busy being astonished by how calm he himself had become. After his long and agonizing soul-searching, he was apparently going to perform his duty without qualms. Admiral Heilmann became confused during the entering of his code. He admitted that he was nervous, and temporarily lost track of where he was in his sequence. The system designers had foreseen this possibility, and had installed two lights, one green and one red, right above the numerical keyboards on the side of the bomb. After every 10th digit, one of the two lights would illuminate, indicating whether or not the previous decade of code was a successful match. The safety committee had expressed concern that this extra feature compromised the system. It would be easier to decrypt 5 10-digit strings than 1 50-digit string, but repeated human engineering tests prior to launch had shown that the lights were necessary. At the end of his second decade of digits, Heilmann was greeted by the flashing red light. "I've done something wrong," he said, his embarrassment obvious. "Louder!" shouted Francesca from where she was filming. She had neatly framed the ceremony so that both the weapons and the pods appeared in the picture. "I have made a mistake," Admiral Heilmann proclaimed. "All this noise has distracted me. I must wait 30 seconds before I can start again." After Heilmann had successfully completed his code, Dr. Brown entered the activation code on the second weapon. He seemed almost bored. Certainly he didn't push the keyboard with anything approaching enthusiasm. Irina Turgenev activated the third bomb. She made a short but passionate comment, underscoring her belief that the destruction of Rama was absolutely essential. Neither Hiro Yamanaka nor Francesca said anything at all. Francesca, however, did impress the rest of the crew by doing her first 30 digits from memory. Considering that she had supposedly never seen Heilmann's code until an hour earlier, and had not been alone for more than 2 minutes since then, her feat was quite remarkable. Next, it was General O'Toole's turn. Smiling comfortably, he walked easily up to the first weapon. The other cosmonauts applauded, both showing their respect for the general and acknowledging his struggle. He asked everyone please to be quiet, explaining that he had committed his whole sequence to memory. Then O'Toole entered the first decade of digits. He stopped for a second as the green light flashed. In that instant, an image flashed into his mind of one of the frescoes on the second floor of the Shrine of St. Michael in Rome. A young man in a blue robe, his eyes uplifted to the heavens, was standing on the steps of the Victor Emmanuel Monument, preaching to an appreciative multitude. General O'Toole heard a voice, loudly and distinctly. The voice said, "No." The general spun around quickly. Did anybody say anything? He said, staring at the other cosmonauts. They shook their heads. Befuddled, O'Toole turned back to the bomb. He tried to remember the second decade of digits, but it was no good. His heart was racing at breakneck speed. His mind kept saying, over and over again, what was that voice? His resolve to perform his duty had vanished. Michael O'Toole took a deep breath, turned around again, and walked across the huge bay. When he passed his stunned colleagues, he heard Admiral Heilmann yell, "What are you doing?" "I'm going to my room," O'Toole said without breaking stride.
"Aren't you going to activate the bombs?"
Dr. Brown said behind him.
"No," replied General O'Toole. "At least, not yet."
Chapter 56 An Answered Prayer. General O'Toole stayed in his room the rest of the day. Admiral Heilmann dropped by about an hour after O'Toole's failure to enter his code. After some meaningless small talk, Heilmann was terrible at that sort of thing, the Admiral asked the all-important question.
"Are you ready to proceed with the activation?"
O'Toole shook his head.
"I thought I was this morning, Otto, but..."
There was no need for him to say anything more. Heilmann rose from his chair.
"I've given orders for Yamanaka to take the first two bullets to the passageway inside Rama. They'll be there by dinner if you change your mind. The other three will be left in the bay for the time being."
He stared at his colleague for several seconds.
"I hope you come to your senses before too much longer, Michael. We're already in deep trouble at headquarters."
When Francesca came in with her camera 2 hours later, it was clear from her choice of words that the attitude toward the general, at least among the remaining cosmonauts, was that O'Toole was suffering from acute nervous tension. He wasn't being defiant. He wasn't making a statement. None of the rest of the crew could have tolerated those alternatives, because they would all look bad by association. No, it was obvious that there was something wrong with his nerves.
"I've told everyone not to bother you with calls," Francesca said compassionately as she glanced around the room,
her television mind already framing the images of the coming interview.
"The phones have been ringing like crazy, especially since I sent down the tape from this morning."
She walked over to his desk, checking the objects on its top.
"Is this Michael of Siena?"
Francesca asked, picking up the small statue. O'Toole managed a wan smile.
"Yes," he said. "And I think you know the man on the cross in the picture."
"Very well," Francesca replied. "Very well indeed." "Look, Michael, you know what's coming. I would like for this interview to paint you in the best possible light. Not that I'm going to treat you with kid gloves, you understand, but I want to make certain that those wolves down there hear your side of the story."
"They're already screaming for my hide,"
O'Toole interrupted.
"Oh, yes," she answered, "and it will get much worse. The longer you delay activating the bombs, the more wrath will be aimed at you."
"But why?" O'Toole protested.
"I haven't committed a crime. I've simply delayed activating a weapon whose destructive power exceeds..."
"That's irrelevant," Francesca retorted. "In their eyes, you haven't done your job, namely to protect the people on the planet Earth. They're frightened. They don't understand all this extraterrestrial crap. They've been told that Rama will be destroyed, and now you've refused to remove their nightmares."
"Nightmares,"
mumbled O'Toole.
"That's what Bothwell..."
"What about President Bothwell?" inquired Francesca.
"Oh, nothing," he said.
He looked away from her probing eyes.
"What else?"
O'Toole asked impatiently.
"As I was saying, I want you to look as good as possible. Comb your hair again and put on a fresh uniform, not a flight suit. I'll daub a little makeup on your face so you don't look washed out."
She returned to the desk.
"We'll place your family photos in full view next to Jesus and Michael. Think carefully about what you're going to say. Of course, I'll ask why you failed to activate the weapons this morning."
Francesca walked over and put her hand on O'Toole's shoulder.
"In my introduction, I will have suggested that you've been under a strain. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but admitting a little weakness will probably play well, particularly in your country."
General O'Toole squirmed while Francesca finished the preparations for the interview.
"Do I have to do this?"
he asked, becoming more and more uncomfortable as the journalist essentially rearranged his room.
"Only if you want anybody to think you're not Benedict Arnold," was her curt reply.
Janos came in to visit just before dinner.
"Your interview with Francesca was very good," he lied.
At least you raise some moral issues that all of us should consider.
It was dumb of me to bring up all that philosophical crap, O'Toole fretted. I should have followed Francesca's advice and blamed everything on my fatigue.
Well, Michael, said Janos,
what's done is done. I didn't come in here to review the events of the day. I'm certain you've done that plenty of times already. I came in here to see if I could be of any help.
I don't think so, Janos, he replied. But I do appreciate the thought.
There was a long hiatus in the conversation. At length, Janos stood up and shuffled toward the door.
What do you do now?
He asked, quietly.
I wish I knew, O'Toole answered. I don't seem to be able to come up with a plan.
The combined Rama-Newton spacecraft continued to hurtle toward the Earth. With each passing day, the Rama threat loomed greater, a huge cylinder moving at hyperbolic speed toward what would be a calamitous impact if no new mid-course corrections were made. The estimated crash point was in the state of Tamil Nadu, in South India, not far from the city of Madurai. Physicists were on the network news every night, explaining what could be expected. Shockwaves and ejector became terms bandied about at dinner parties. Michael O'Toole was vilified by the global press. Francesca had been right. The American general became the focus of a world's fury. There were even suggestions that he should be court-martialed and executed on board the Newton for his failure to follow orders. A lifetime of important accomplishments and selfless contributions was forgotten. Kathleen O'Toole was forced to leave the family apartment in Boston and take refuge with a friend in Maine. The general was tortured by his indecision. He knew that he was doing irreparable damage to his family and his career by his failure to activate the weapons. But each time he convinced himself he was ready to execute the order, that loud and resounding no echoed again in his ears. O'Toole was only marginally coherent in his final interview with Francesca, the day before the scientific ship left to return to the Earth. She asked some very tough questions. When Francesca asked him why, if Rama were going to orbit the Earth, it had not yet made a deflection maneuver, the general perked up momentarily and reminded her that aerobraking, dissipating energy in the atmosphere as heat, was the most efficient method of achieving orbit around a planetary body with an atmosphere. But when she gave him a chance to amplify his statement, to discuss how Rama might reconfigure itself to have aerodynamic surfaces, O'Toole did not answer. He just stared at her, distractedly. O'Toole came out of his room for the final dinner the night before Brown, Sabatini, Tabori, and Turgenev departed for home. His presence spoiled the last supper. Irina was extremely nasty to him, upbraiding the general venomously and refusing to sit at the same table. David Brown ignored him altogether, choosing instead to discuss in excruciating detail the laboratory being designed in Texas to accommodate the captured crab biot. Only Francesca and Janos were friendly, so General O'Toole returned to his room right after dinner without formally saying goodbye to anyone. The next morning, less than an hour after the scientific ship had left, O'Toole buzzed Admiral Heilmann and asked for a meeting.
"So, you have finally changed your mind,"
the German said excitedly when the general entered his office.
"Good. It's not too late yet. It's only 1-12 days. If we hurry, we can still detonate the bombs at 1-9.
"I'm getting closer, Otto," O'Toole replied. "But I'm not there yet. I've been thinking about all this very carefully. There are two things I would still like to do. I'd like to talk to Pope John Paul, and I want to go inside to see Rama for myself."
O'Toole's response left Heilmann deflated.
"Shit," he said. "Here we go again."
"You don't understand, Otto," the American said.
He stared fixedly at his colleague.
"This is good news. Unless something totally unexpected occurs, either during my call to the Pope or while I'm exploring Rama, I'll be ready to enter my code the minute I come out."
"Are you certain?" Heilmann asked.
"I give you my word," O'Toole replied.
General O'Toole held nothing back in his long, emotional transmission to the Pope. He was aware that his call was being monitored, but it no longer mattered. A single thing was uppermost in his mind: making the decision to activate the nuclear weapons with a clear conscience. He waited impatiently for the reply. When Pope John Paul V finally appeared on the screen, he was sitting in the same room in the Vatican where O'Toole had had his audience just after Christmas. The Pope was holding a small electronic pad in his right hand, and occasionally glanced down as he spoke.
"I have prayed with you, my son,"
the pontiff began in his precise English,
"particularly during this last week of your personal turmoil. I cannot tell you what to do. I do not have the answers any more than you do. We can only hope together that God, in his wisdom, will provide unambiguous answers to your prayers. In response to some of your religious inquiries, however, I can make a few comments. I offer them to you in the hope that they will be helpful. I cannot say whether or not the voice you heard was that of St. Michael, or if you had what is known as a religious experience. I can affirm that there is a category of human experience, usually called religious for lack of a better term, that exists and cannot be explained in purely rational or scientific terms. Saul of Tarsus was definitely blinded by a light from the heavens as part of his conversion to Christianity before he became the Apostle Paul. Your voice may have been St. Michael. Only you can decide. As we discussed 3 months ago, God certainly created the Romans, whoever they were. But he also created the viruses and bacteria that cause human death and suffering. Cannot glorify God, either individually or as a species, if we do not survive. It seems unlikely to me that God would expect us to take no action if our very survival were threatened. The possible role of Rama as a herald for the second coming of Christ is a difficult issue. There are some priests inside the church who agree with St. Michael, although they are a distinct minority. Most of us feel that the Rama craft are too spiritually sterile to be heralds. They are incredible engineering marvels, to be sure, but there is nothing about them that suggests any warmth or compassion or any other redeeming characteristic that is associated with Christ. It therefore seems very unlikely that Rama has any strictly religious significance. In the end, it is a decision you must make yourself. You must continue your prayers, as I'm certain you realize, but maybe expect a little less fanfare in God's response. He does not speak to everyone in the same way, nor will each of his messages to you come in the same form. Please, remember one more thing. As you explore Rama in search of God's will, the prayers of many on earth will go with you. You can be certain that God will give you an answer. Your challenge is to identify and interpret it.
John Paul ended his transmission with a blessing and a recitation of the Lord's Prayer. General O'Toole knelt automatically and spoke the words along with his spiritual leader. When the screen was blank, he reviewed what the pontiff had said and felt reassured. "I must be on the right track," O'Toole said to himself, "but I should not expect a heavenly proclamation with accompanying trumpets." O'Toole was not prepared for his powerful emotional response to Rama. Perhaps it was the sheer scale of the spacecraft, so much larger than anything ever built by human beings. Perhaps also his long confinement on the Newton and heightened emotional state contributed to the intensity of his feelings. Whatever the reasons, Michael O'Toole was totally overwhelmed by the spectacle as he made his solitary way into the giant spacecraft. There was no specific feature that dominated the rest in O'Toole's mind. His throat caught and his eyes brimmed with tears of wonder on several different occasions. Riding down the chairlift on his initial descent and looking out across the central plain with its long illuminated strips that were Rama's light, standing beside the rover on the shores of the cylindrical sea and staring through his binoculars at the mysterious skyscrapers of New York, and gawking many times, like all the cosmonauts before him, at the gigantic horns and buttresses that adorned the southern bowl. O'Toole's dominant feelings were awe and reverence, much as he had felt the first time he had entered one of the old European cathedrals. He spent the Raman night at Beta, using one of the extra huts left by the cosmonauts on the second sortie. He found Wakefield's message dated 2 weeks earlier, and had a momentary desire to assemble the sailboat and cross over to New York. But O'Toole restrained himself and focused on the true purpose of his visit. He admitted to himself that although Rama was a spectacular achievement, its magnificence should not be a relevant factor in his evaluation process. Was there anything he had seen that would cause him to alter his tentative conclusion? No, he grudgingly answered. When the lights came on again inside the giant cylinder, O'Toole was confident that before the next Raman nightfall, he would activate the weapons. Still, he procrastinated. He drove the entire length of the coastline, examining New York and the other vistas from different vantage points, and observing the 500-meter cliff on the opposite side of the sea. On one last pass through the Beta campsite, O'Toole decided to pick up some odds and ends, including a few personal mementos left behind by the other crew members in their hasty retreat from Rama. Not many items had escaped the hurricane, but he found some souvenirs that had been trapped in corners against the supply crates. General O'Toole took a long nap before he guided the rover back to the bottom of the chairlift. Realizing what he was going to do when he reached the Newton, O'Toole knelt down and prayed one last time before ascending. Shortly into his ride, when he was still less than half a kilometer above the central plain, he turned in his chair and looked back across the Raman panorama. Soon, this will all be gone, O'Toole thought, enveloped in a solar furnace unleashed by man. His eyes lifted from the plain and focused on New York. He thought he saw a moving black speck in the Raman sky. With trembling hands, he lifted his binoculars to his eyes. In a few seconds, O'Toole located the enlarged speck. He quickly changed the binocular resolution, and the speck split into three parts, each a bird soaring in formation far off in the distance. O'Toole blinked, but the image did not change. There were indeed three birds flying in the Raman sky. Joy filled General O'Toole. He yelled with delight as he followed the birds with his binoculars until he could no longer see them. The remaining 30 minutes of the ride to the top of the Alpha stairway seemed like a lifetime. The American officer immediately climbed into another chair and descended again into Rama. He wanted desperately to see those birds one more time. If I could somehow photograph them, he thought, planning to drive back to the cylindrical sea if necessary, then I could prove to everyone that there are also living creatures in this amazing world. Starting 2 kilometers above the floor, O'Toole searched in vain for the birds as he descended. Only slightly disheartened by his failure to find them, he was subsequently dumbfounded by what he saw when he dropped his binoculars from his eyes and prepared to disembark from the chair. Richard Wakefield and Nicole Desjardins were standing side by side at the bottom of the lift. General O'Toole embraced them each with a vigorous hug, and then, with tears of happiness running down his cheeks, he knelt on the soil of Rama.
"Dear God," he said as he offered his silent prayer of thanks. "Dear God," he repeated.
Chapter 57 Three's Company. The three cosmonauts talked avidly for over an hour. There was so much to tell. When Nicole told of her fright upon encountering the dead Takagishi in the Octospider lair, O'Toole was momentarily silent, and then shook his head.
"There are so many unanswered questions here," he said, staring up at the high ceiling. "Are you really malevolent after all?" he asked, rhetorically.
Richard and Nicole both praised the general's courage in not entering his code to activate the weapons. They were also both horrified that the COG had ordered the destruction of Rama.
"It is absolutely unforgivable for us to use nuclear weapons against this spaceship," Nicole said. "I am convinced that it is not fundamentally hostile, and I believe that Rama maneuvered to intercept the Earth because it has a specific message for us."
Richard lightly chided Nicole for developing her opinion more on the basis of emotions than facts.
"Perhaps," she rejoined, "but there is a serious logical flaw as well in this decision to destroy. We now have hard evidence that this vehicle communicated with its predecessor. There is good reason to suspect that a Rama 3 is out there somewhere, probably coming in this direction. If the Rama fleet is potentially hostile, there is no way the Earth will be able to escape. We may succeed in destroying this second craft, but in so doing we will almost certainly alert their next ship. Since their technology is so much more advanced than ours, we would have no possibility of surviving their concerted attack."
General O'Toole looked at Nicole with admiration.
"That's an excellent point," he said. "It's a shame you weren't available for the ISA discussions. We never considered... Why don't we postpone the rest of this conversation until we're back on the Newton?" Richard said suddenly. "According to my watch, it will be dark again in another 30 minutes, before any of us have reached the top of the lift. I don't want to ride in the dark any longer than is necessary."
Each of the three cosmonauts believed that they were leaving Rama for the last time. As the remaining minutes of light dwindled, Each cosmonaut gazed intently at the magnificent alien landscape that stretched out into the distance. For Nicole, the dominant feeling was one of elation. Cautious by nature with her expectations, until this moment in the chairlift, she had not allowed herself the intense pleasure of believing that she would ever again hold her beloved Genevieve in her arms. Her mind was now flooded by the bucolic beauty of Beauvoir, and she imagined in detail the joy of her reunion scene with her father and daughter. It could be as little as a week, or 10 days, Nicole said to herself expectantly. By the time she reached the top, she was having difficulty containing her jubilation. During his ride, Michael O'Toole reviewed one more time his activation decision. When dark came to Rama, suddenly, and at the predicted moment, he had finished developing his plan for communicating his decision to the Earth. They would phone ISA management immediately. Nicole and Richard would summarize their stories, and Nicole would present her reasons for thinking that the destruction of Rama would be unforgivable. O'Toole was convinced that his order to activate the weapons would then be rescinded. The general switched on his flashlight just before his chair reached the top of the stairway. He stepped off in the weightless environment and stood beside Nicole. They waited for Richard Wakefield before proceeding together around the ramp to the ferry passageway, only 100 meters away. After the trio had boarded the ferry and were ready to move through the Rama shell toward the Newton, Richard's flashlight beam fell on a large metal object on the side of the passage.
"Is that one of the bombs?" he asked.
The nuclear weapon system did indeed resemble an oversized bullet. How curious, Nicole thought, recoiling as an instant shudder ran through her system. It could be any shape, of course. I wonder what subconscious aberration made the designers choose that particular form.
But what's that weird contraption at the top?
Richard was asking O'Toole. The general's brow furrowed as he stared at a bizarre object illuminated by the center of the beam of light.
I don't know, he confessed. I've never seen it before.
He disembarked from the ferry. Richard and Nicole followed him. General O'Toole shuffled over to the weapon and studied the strange attachment fixed above the numerical keyboard. It was a flat plate, slightly larger than the keyboard itself, that was anchored by angular joints to the sides of the weapon. On the underside of the plate, momentarily retracted, were 10 tiny punches. At least, that's what they looked like to O'Toole. His observation was confirmed seconds later when one of the punches extended and hit the number 5 on the keyboard several centimeters below. The 5 was followed in rapid succession by a 7, and then by 8 more numbers before a green light flashed the successful completion of the first decade. Within seconds, the apparatus entered 10 more digits, and another green light flashed. O'Toole froze in terror. My God, he thought. That's my code. Somehow they've broken. His panic subsided an instant later when, after the third decade of digits, the red light announced that an error had been made. Apparently, General O'Toole said a short time later in response to an inquiry from Richard, they have jerry-rigged this scheme to try to enter the code in my absence. They only have the first 2 decades correct. For a moment I was afraid. O'Toole paused, aware of strong emotions stirring within him.
They must have assumed you weren't coming back, Nicole said in a matter-of-fact tone.
If Heilman and Yamanaka did it, O'Toole replied. Of course we can't rule out completely the possibility that the contraption might have been placed there by the aliens, or even the Biots.
Extremely unlikely, Richard commented. The engineering is much too crude.
At any rate, O'Toole said, opening his backpack for some tools to disconnect the apparatus. I'm not taking any chances.
At the Newton end of the passageway, O'Toole, Wakefield, and Desjardins found the second bomb fitted with the same apparatus. The trio watched it punch out one code attempt, with the same result, a failure somewhere in the third decade, and then they disabled it as well. Afterward, they opened up the seal and exited from Rama. Nobody greeted them when they stepped inside the Newton military ship. General O'Toole assumed that both Admiral Heilman and Yamanaka were asleep, and went immediately to the bedrooms. He wanted to talk to Heilman in private anyway. But the two men were not in their rooms. It did not take long to confirm, in fact, that the other 2 cosmonauts were nowhere in the comparatively small living and working area of the military ship. A search of the supply area in the back of the ship was also futile.
However, the threesome did discover that one of the extravehicular activity, EVA pods, was missing. This discovery raised another perplexing set of questions. Where could Hauman and Yamanaka have gone in the pod? And why had they violated the top priority project policy that at least one crew member should always stay on board the Newton? The three cosmonauts were puzzled as they returned to the control center to discuss their possible courses of action. O'Toole was the first to raise the specter of foul play. Do you think those octo-spiders or even some of the biots might have come on board? After all, it's not difficult to enter the Newton unless it's in self-protection mode. Nobody wanted to say what all three of them were thinking. If someone or something had captured or killed their two colleagues on the ship, then it might still be around, and they might be in danger themselves.
"Why don't we call the Earth and announce that we're alive?"
Richard said, breaking the silence.
"Great idea,"
General O'Toole smiled. He moved over to the control center console and activated the panel. A standard system status display appeared on the large screen.
"That's strange," the general commented.
"According to this, we have no video link with the Earth presently. Only low-rate telemetry."
Now, why would the data system configuration have been changed? He keyed in a simple set of commands to establish the normal multi-channel high-rate link with the Earth. A swarm of error messages appeared on the monitor.
"What the hell?"
Richard exclaimed.
"It looks as if the video system has died."
He turned to O'Toole.
"This is your speciality, General. What do you make of all this?"
General O'Toole was very serious.
"I don't like it, Richard. I've only seen this many error messages one time before. During one of our early simulations, when some nincompoop forgot to load the communication software. We must have a major software problem. The probability of that many hardware failures in such a short time span is essentially zero."
Richard suggested that O'Toole subject the video communication software to its standard self-test. During the test, the diagnostic printout reported that the error buffers in the self-test algorithm had overflowed when the procedure was less than 1% complete.
"So the VidCom software is definitely the culprit,"
Richard said, analyzing the data in the diagnostic. He entered some commands.
"It's going to take a while to straighten it out."
"Just a minute,"
Nicole interrupted.
"Shouldn't we spend some time trying to make some sense out of all this new information before we start on any specific tasks?"
The two men stopped their activity and waited for her to continue.
"Hauman, Yamanaka, and one pod are missing from this ship," Nicole said,
walking slowly around the control center.
"And someone was trying to automatically activate the two nuclear bombs in the passageway. Meanwhile, the VidCom software, after functioning properly for hundreds of days, counting all the pre-flight simulations, has suddenly gone haywire. Do either of you have a coherent explanation for all this?"
There was a long silence.
"General O'Toole's suggestion of a hostile invasion of the Newton might work,"
Richard offered.
"Hauman and Yamanaka might have fled to save themselves, and the aliens could have purposely screwed up the software."
Nicole was not convinced.
"Nothing I have seen suggested any aliens, or even any biots for that matter, have been inside the Newton. Unless we see some evidence."
"Maybe Hauman and Yamanaka were trying to break the general's code,"
Wakefield invented.
"And they were afraid—"
"Stop! Stop!"
Nicole shouted suddenly.
"Something's happening to the screen."
The two men turned around just in time to see Admiral Otto Heilmann's face materialize on the monitor.
"Hello, General O'Toole," Heilmann said with a smile from the huge screen. "This videotape was triggered by your entering the Newton airlock. Cosmonaut Yamanaka and I prepared it just before we departed in one of the pods, 3 hours before 1-9 days. We were ordered to evacuate less than an hour after you went inside to explore Rama. We delayed as long as we could, but eventually had to follow our instructions. Your personal orders are simple and straightforward. You are to enter your activation code into the two weapons in the ferry passageway and the three remaining in the bay. You should depart in the final pod no more than 8 hours thereafter. Don't be concerned about the electronic devices in operation on the two bombs in the Raman shell. COG military headquarters ordered them put in place to test some new top-secret decryption techniques. You will discover they can easily be disabled with pliers and or wire cutters. An extra emergency propulsion system has been added to the pod and its software has been programmed to guide you to a safe location, where you will rendezvous with an ISA tug. All you need to do is code in the exact time of your departure. However,
I must stress that the new pod navigation algorithms are valid only if you leave the Newton before 1-6 days. After that time, I am told the guidance parameters become increasingly invalid, and it will be almost impossible to rescue you.
There was a short pause in Heilman's delivery, and his voice took on an increased sense of urgency.
Don't waste any more time, Michael. Activate the weapons and go directly to the pod. We have already supplied it with the food and other essentials that you will need. Good luck on your voyage home. We'll see you back on Earth.
Chapter 58 Hobson's Choice.
I'm certain that Heilman and Yamanaka were being extremely cautious, Richard Wakefield explained. They probably left early so they could take extra supplies. And with these lightweight pods, each extra kilogram can be critical.
How critical? Asked Nicole.
Well, it could make all the difference between getting into a safe orbit around Earth, or shooting past it so quickly that we couldn't be rescued.
Does that mean, O'Toole inquired somberly, that only one of us might be able to use the pod?
Richard paused before answering.
I'm afraid that's possible. It's a function of the time of departure. We'll have to do some quick calculations to determine exactly. But personally, I see no reason why we shouldn't consider flying this entire spaceship. I was trained as a backup pilot, after all. We have only limited control authority, since the ship is so large, but if we jettison everything we don't absolutely need, we may be able to do it. Again, we'll need to do the computations.
Nicole's assignments from General O'Toole and Richard were to check the supplies that had been placed in the pod, determine their adequacy, and then approximate both the mass and packaging volume required to support either 2 or 3 travelers. In addition, Richard, still favoring flying back to Earth in the military ship, asked Nicole to go through the Newton supply manifest and estimate how much mass could be thrown overboard. While O'Toole and Wakefield used the computers in the control center, Nicole worked alone in the huge bay. First, she examined the remaining pod very carefully. Although the pods were normally used by a single person for EVA, they had also been designed as emergency escape vehicles. 2 people could sit behind the tough, transparent front window with a week's supplies on the shelves at the rear of the small cabin. But 3 people? Nicole wondered. Impossible. Someone would have to squeeze into the shelf space, and then there would not be adequate room for the supplies. Nicole thought momentarily about being confined to the tiny shelves for 7 or 8 days. It would be even worse than the pit in New York. She looked through the supplies that had been hastily thrown into the pod by Heilman and Yamanaka. The food allocation was more or less correct, both in quantity and variety, for a 1-week voyage. The medical kit, however, was woefully inadequate. Nicole made a few notes, constructed what she considered to be a proper supply list for either a 2 or 3-person crew, and estimated the mass and packaging requirements. She then started to cross the bay. Her eyes were drawn to the bullet-shaped nuclear weapons, lying placidly on their sides right beside the pod airlock. Nicole walked over and touched the bombs, her hands idly running across the polished metal surface. So, these are the first great weapons of destruction, she thought, the outcome of the brilliant physics of the 20th century. What a sad commentary on our species, Nicole mused, as she was walking among the nuclear bombs. A visitor comes to see us. It cannot speak our language, but it does discover where we live. When it turns the corner onto our street, while its purpose is still utterly unknown, we blast it into oblivion. She shuffled across the bay toward the living quarters, aware of a profound feeling of sadness deep within her. Your problem, Nicole said to herself, is that you always expect too much. From yourself. From those you love. Even from the human race. We are yet too immature a species. A momentary wave of nausea forced Nicole to stop for a moment. What's this? She thought. Are these bombs making me ill? In the back of her mind, Nicole recalled a similar feeling of nausea 15 years before, 2 hours into her flight from Los Angeles to Paris. It can't be, she told herself. But I'll check just to be certain.
That's the second reason why the 3 of us cannot all fit in a single pod. Don't feel bad, Nicole. Even if the physical space could accommodate our bodies and the needed supplies, the velocity change capability of the pod, with all that mass, is barely enough to close the orbit around the sun.
our chances of being rescued would be virtually nil.
Well, Nicole replied to Richard, trying to be cheerful,
at least we still have the other option. We can go home in this big vehicle. According to my estimates, we can dump in excess of 10,000 kilograms.
I'm afraid it doesn't matter, General O'Toole interrupted. Nicole looked at Richard.
What's he talking about?
Richard Wakefield stood up and walked over to Nicole. He took her hands in his.
They screwed up the navigation system, too, Richard said.
They're automatic search algorithms. The big number crunchers being used to try to decrypt O'Toole's code were overlaid into the general-purpose computers on top of the VidCom and navigation subroutines. This ship is useless as a transportation module.
General O'Toole's voice was distant and lacked its usual upbeat timbre.
They must have started only minutes after I left. Richard read the command buffers and found out that the decryption software was uplinked less than 2 hours after my departure.
But why would they incapacitate the Newton? Nicole asked.
Don't you understand? O'Toole said with passion. The priorities had changed. Nothing was as important as detonating the nuclear weapons. They didn't want to waste the time for the radio signals to go back and forth to Earth. So they moved the computations up here, where each successive candidate code could be commanded from the computer without delay.
In fairness to Mission Control, Richard interjected, now pacing around the room, we should acknowledge that the fully loaded Newton military ship actually has less orbit change capability than a two-person pod with an auxiliary propulsion system. In the eyes of the ISA safety manager, there was no increased risk associated with making this craft inoperable.
But none of this should have happened in the first place, the general argued.
Damn it! Why couldn't they just have waited for my return?
Nicole sat down abruptly in one of the available chairs. Her head was spinning, and she felt momentarily dizzy.
What's the matter? Richard said, approaching her with alarm.
I have been having occasional periods of nausea today, Nicole replied. I think I'm pregnant.
I'll know for certain in about 20 minutes.
She smiled at the dumbfounded Richard.
It's extremely rare for a woman to become pregnant within 90 days of an injection of neutrobriolate, but it has happened before. I don't suppose—
Congratulations, an enthusiastic General O'Toole suddenly interrupted. I had no idea that the two of you were planning to have a family.
Nor did I, Richard replied, still looking shocked. He gave Nicole a vigorous hug and held her close.
Nor did I, he repeated. There will be no more discussion of this subject, General O'Toole said emphatically to Richard. Even if Nicole weren't pregnant with your child, I would insist that the two of you go in the pod and leave me here. It's the only sensible decision. In the first place, we both know that mass is the most critical parameter and I am the heaviest of the three of us by far. In addition, I am old, and you two are both quite young. You know how to fly the pod. I've never even trained inside it a single time. Besides, he added dryly, I will be court-martialed on Earth for refusing to follow orders. As for you, my good doctor, O'Toole continued moments later, I don't need to tell you that you are carrying a very special baby. He or she will be the only human child that was ever conceived inside an extraterrestrial space vehicle.
He stood up and glanced around.
Now, he said, I propose we open a bottle of wine and celebrate our last evening together.
Nicole watched General O'Toole glide over to the larder. He opened it and started rummaging around.
I'm perfectly happy with fruit juice, Michael, she said. I shouldn't drink more than a single glass of wine now, anyway.
Of course, he replied quickly. I temporarily forgot. I was hoping that we could do something special on this last night. I wanted to share one last time.
General O'Toole stopped himself and brought the wine and juice back to the table. He handed cups to both Richard and Nicole.
I want you both to know, he said quietly,
his mood now subdued, that I cannot imagine a finer pair of people than the two of you. I wish you every success, especially with the baby. The three cosmonauts drank in silence for several seconds.
We all know it, don't we?
General O'Toole said in a barely audible tone. The missiles must be on their way.
How long do you figure I have, Richard?
Judging from what Admiral Heilman said on the tape, I would say that the first missile would reach Rama at 1-5 days.
That would be consistent both with the pod being outside the debris field and the deflection velocities that must be imparted to the surviving pieces of the spacecraft.
You two have lost me, Nicole said. What missiles are we talking about?
Richard leaned over toward her.
Both Michael and I are certain, he said gravely, that the COG has ordered a missile strike against Rama. They had no assurance that the General would ever return to the Newton and enter his code. And the search algorithm with the automatic punch was a long shot at best. Only a missile strike could guarantee that Rama would not have the capability of harming our planet.
So, I have a little more than 48 hours to make my final peace with God, General O'Toole said after reflecting for several seconds. I have lived a fabulous life. I have much to be thankful for. I will go into his arms without regret.
Chapter 59 Dream of Destiny. As Nicole stretched her arms over her head and to her sides, she brushed against Richard on her left and one of the water containers hanging slightly out of the shelf behind her.
It's going to be crowded, she observed, squirming in her seat.
Yes, it is,
Richard replied, distractedly. His attention was focused on the display in front of the pilot's seat in the pod. He entered some commands and waited for the response. When it finally came, Richard frowned.
I guess I'll make one more attempt to repackage the supplies, Nicole said with a sigh.
She turned around in her seat and stared at the shelves.
I could save us some room and 14 kilograms if our rescue was guaranteed in 7 days.
Richard did not respond.
Damn it,
he muttered when a set of numbers appeared on the display.
What's the matter? Nicole asked.
There's something not quite right here, Richard said. The navigation code was developed for considerably less payload mass. It may not converge if we lose one of the accelerometers.
Nicole waited patiently for Richard to explain.
So if we have any hiccups along the way, we will probably have to stop for several hours and reinitialize.
But I thought you said there was plenty of fuel for the two of us.
Plenty of fuel, yes. However, there are some subtleties in the reprogrammed navigation algorithms that assume the pod contains less than 100 kilograms, basically only O'Toole and his supplies.
Nicole could read the concern in Richard's brow.
We're all right, I think, if there are no malfunctions, he continued, but no pod has ever been operated under conditions like this.
Through the front window they could see General O'Toole walking across the bay toward them. He was carrying a small object in his hand. It was TB, one of Richard's tiny Shakespearean robots.
I almost forgot I had him,
O'Toole said a minute later, after he had been thanked profusely by Richard. Cosmonaut Wakefield was soaring around the supply depot like a joyous child, a wide smile on his delighted face.
I thought I'd never see any of them again,
Richard yelled from one of the side walls, where his exuberant momentum had carried him.
I was passing your room, General O'Toole shouted back. Right before the scientific ship departed, Cosmonaut Tabori was arranging your things. He asked me to keep that particular robot just in case.
Thank you, Janos, Richard said.
He walked carefully down the wall and anchored himself to the floor.
This is a very special one, Michael, he said with a gleam in his eye.
He switched on TB's power.
Do you know any Shakespearean sonnets?
There's one that Kathleen especially likes, if I can recall it. I think the first line is, That time of year thou mayst...
That time of year thou mayst in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang, upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day, as after sunset fadeth in the west.
The feminine voice, coming from TB, startled both Nicole and General O'Toole. The words struck a resonant chord in O'Toole. He was deeply moved, and a few tears welled up in the corners of his eyes. Nicole took the General's hand and squeezed it compassionately after TB had finished the sonnet.
You didn't say anything to Michael about the problems you found with the pod navigation, Nicole said.
She and Richard were lying side by side in one of the small bedrooms on the military ship.
No,
replied Richard, quietly.
I didn't want to worry him. He believes that we are going to be safe, and I don't want him to think differently.
Nicole extended her arm and touched Richard.
We could stay here, darling.
Then at least Michael would survive.
He rolled over toward her.
She could tell he was looking at her, even though she couldn't see him very clearly in the dark.
I thought about that, Richard said. But he would never accept it. I even thought about sending you by yourself. Would you want to do that?
No, Nicole answered, after thinking for a moment. I don't think so.
I'd rather go with you. Unless...
Unless what?
Unless there really is a big difference in the odds. If one of us can survive, but two of us are almost certainly doomed, it doesn't make much sense.
I can't give you an accurate probabilistic assessment, Richard interrupted. But I don't think there's a major difference if we go together. My knowledge of the pod and its system might almost be worth the extra mass. But either way, we're better off in the pod than if we stay here.
You're absolutely convinced that missiles are on the way, aren't you?
Yes, indeed. Nothing else makes sense. I would bet that such a contingency plan was under development as soon as Rama changed course and headed for the Earth.
They were silent again. Nicole tried to sleep, but was unsuccessful. They had both decided to rest for 6 hours before departing, so that they could store some energy for what would doubtless be an exhausting voyage. Nicole's mind, however, would not turn off. She kept imagining General O'Toole perishing in a nuclear fireball.
"He really is a wonderful man," Nicole said very quietly.
She wasn't certain if Richard was still awake.
"Yes, he is," Richard answered in the same tone. "I envy his inner strength. I can't imagine giving up my own life for someone else so willingly."
He paused for a moment.
"I guess that comes from his deep religious beliefs."